HRN has a brand new look, but we're sharing the same delicious stories. Invest in the future of food radio by becoming a monthly sustaining member at heritageradio.org/donate. Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum, and I love to talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. If you're just tuning in for the first time, all the previous episodes can be found in the archives at heritageradionetwork.org. I'm thankful for listeners like you, and I'd love it if you'd leave me a review wherever you find this podcast. We've just rebranded here at HRN. We have a new look, and we have a new website, so I really would love it if you would go and check it out. Heritage Radio is a nonprofit, and we need your help to stay on the air. If you enjoy this show and listen to the other great podcasts we produce every week, please go check out our new site at heritageradionetwork.org/donate and make your gift today. And for those of you with kids at home, I'd love to be so bold as to suggest you check out my other podcast. Along with my co-host Hannah Forden, the program manager here at HRN, we've created Time for Lunch, a fun, food-focused show for kids. We'd love it if you'd check it out wherever you get your podcasts. Today's theme, 98 million acres. When I moved to Rhode Island, I knew that it was a small state in the populous northeastern United States. But I was able to find areas without people. I was in the woods, I could see wildlife, feel like I was a small part in the larger natural world. I also know that Alaska is a whole different level of wilderness. It's enormous, far north, extreme, and not thickly settled like we are in the Northeast. When I spoke with Kirsten Dixon a few weeks ago about her life in Alaska, she mentioned that they have a 100 million acre backyard, so to speak, at their Winter Lake Lodge. When I did a quick search, I realized that her backyard is bigger than the entire state where I live, and that is just a small part of Alaska. With two lodges, a cafe, and a cooking school, Kirsten and her family run a number of interconnected businesses designed to get you closer to nature in a way that only Alaska can offer. I hope to visit them sometime and see what that size and scale is all about.
My name is Kirsten Dixon. I, along with my family, own two small wilderness lodges in Alaska. So there, we live kind of off-grid in the backcountry of South Central Alaska. And we have one small cafe in the harbor of a seaside town called Homer.
And do those businesses operate year-round?
We do operate year-round. The little cafe in Homer shuts down at the end of September. Tutka Bay Lodge, which is our ocean-based property, shuts down at the end of September. And then Winter Lake Lodge, it's a Finger Lake checkpoint for the Iditarod sled dog race. And we have sled dogs at that lodge. In the summertime, we put our sled dogs up on icy glacier, and so they can still kind of dog mush and be cool in the, even in the summer. But then in the winter, we have guests come for dog mushing and skiing and other winter sports.
Wow. I mean, it sounds to me, as someone who's from the lower 48 and has never been to Alaska, of course, it's on my list, like it's on many people's lists. It sounds amazing. You know, when I read about your lodges and I, you know, read your book, your most recent book, which I have in front of me, is Living Within the Wild. And that's also your website, right?
So withinthewild.com is our website. Within the Wild's our company name, just to umbrella those three properties. But Living Within the Wild is just a story about how we do live, how we navigate the workload of operating these tiny little backcountry lodges, and our commitment to cuisine and cooking, as well as, you know, a little bit of insight into our lifestyle.
Yeah. So, and you did not grow up originally in Alaska, is that correct?
No. And, you know, a lot of, I would say that a lot of people my age didn't necessarily grow up in Alaska. They moved here. But then now with my daughter's age, I have two daughters, but with them forward, you know, a lot of people have been born in Alaska. But I guess we're just I'm a first generation Alaskan, and Mandy's a second generation. But I came from California, from Northern California. I went to nursing school originally, and I came up here to work in public health, and I worked at the Native Hospital in Anchorage. I worked in the intensive care unit there for a couple of years, and then I met my husband. We quit our jobs. I mean, this is back in the very early 80s, and we were just on a big adventure and having fun in life, and we started a little lodge then. We've since sold that property, but we've never looked back. We've never not done in our entire adult lives the work we're doing now.
I mean, it's amazing. So, one of the chapters in the book is called A Million Acre Picnic. And just so people have some like concept of that, I mean, the idea, right, is that when you look out from one of your properties, that it's basically your backyard is like a million acres, right? That's the idea behind the name.
Yeah, that's at Winter Lake Lodge. So we're right on the sort of the leading edge of the Alaska Range, which the Alaska Range, the mountain range, travels all the kind of along western side of Alaska, all the way up to Denali, and that whole landscape is just right out our back door. We have a helicopter at the lodge, which. I mean, for some years we didn't have a helicopter. I mean, that's kind of an extravagant thing. And then we when we got a helicopter, just the whole world opened up to us. Even just around the corner, there's this gorgeous waterfalls, and then there's these intense, beautiful mountain spires, and there's meadows and a caribou. And I mean, it's just incredible terrain that's still. Literally every day we can take guests out and say, okay, you're touching earth that's never been touched by a human before.
Wow.
And I think that's a really, powerful feeling. I mean, powerful whether those moments that I have when I'm in the natural world like that. I mean, I can have them in urban places too. I can think, going to New York City can be very powerful
Sure.
and, sort of emotional. But I think everyone needs to I hope everyone needs can experience the opportunity to be in natural world, unspoiled places.
Yeah, I mean, I think that our, as someone who spent, I've spent the bulk of my life in the Northeast, where there are, some really cool, what I think of as wild spaces, but that, that's all kind of like fit in like a puzzle piece surrounded by all of this like human intervention. Just to give people a contextual like thing, like I am sitting right now in Rhode Island, and Rhode Island as an entire state is less than a million acres. It's 988,000 acres. So what we're talking about is like you looking out on your backyard and it being the size of an entire all of Rhode Island plus. That's wilderness, right? And like we have a million people in Rhode Island and we're not that far from Boston and we're next to Connecticut and Massachusetts. I mean, there is nothing, you can't be that far from human intervention here, but out there in Alaska, you really can because it's really, really, really big.
Well, we're about an hour. Winter Lake is about an hour by airplane from Anchorage,
Right.
and so within an hour we can travel. And Anchorage is a really fun urban community. I mean, it's certainly not very big, but it has Starbucks and a lot of fun restaurants, and there's a lot of really great people coming into Alaska these days, both farmers that are putting in hard work of growing food sources here, as well as entrepreneurial restaurateurs who are creating really incredible cuisine. We're far off the beaten path in the culinary roadmap, but I think there's something really quite interesting here.
Sure. So let's talk a little bit about both how a person gets to your lodges, either Winter Lake or the other one. Or, I mean, and on top of that, I would love to talk a little bit about culinary influence and how you get your ingredients, because, I've known people and I've spoken to people on this podcast who operate in, far reaches, places out of the way, islands, things like that. But I have to imagine that it's not like, and you guys have a cooking school in an old boat that I also want to touch on, which sounds really cool. I would love to come check it out. But it's not like if suddenly, you drop the, if you drop the tomatoes on the floor, you can't just send somebody out to get more.
Yeah, so both our properties are we fly fixed wing aircraft from Anchorage. Anchorage is our commercial hub. They're basically Winter Lake's about an hour north of Anchorage, and Tutka Bay is about an hour south and change south of Anchorage. So we load and unload those airplanes all the time. They land on water, so the planes are on floats. We call them float planes here. You might call them seaplanes on the East
Sure.
Coast. But we load up our supplies from Anchorage. Now, Alaska, we can't get everything here. We don't probably have the first choice of world produce and product, but it's much, much better than it was 30 years ago. In the early days of me cooking, of course we had no internet and we had very limited communications, and so everything's changed a little bit. But we have definitely a sustainability commitment. We grow our own gardens. We have big greenhouses that we operate year round. We have many relationships with farmers who from whom we sell our or we buy our kitchen produce from. And then
Sure.
there are some ranchers, I guess, that are raising cattle and lamb and pigs and other sort of primal meats as well. We can get some exotic things here like moose meat and other game meat that's not so typical. We do a lot of foraging. That's something we emphasize quite a bit in our cooking school. Alaska, it's very easy to grow organically here because it's so cold in the winter. A lot of bugs don't survive,
Right.
and so we have good organic opportunity here. So and of course we have seafood. We have Alaska seafood, salmon and halibut and crab and all the Pacific Ocean seafood, which we of course emphasize in our cuisine.
Absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of people, myself included, when I think about things that come from Alaska, in a culinary sense or ingredient sense, salmon is probably the first thing that comes to mind. I have a friend and have had him on his on this podcast, and he's been on Heritage Radio Network many times, who his family fishes on Bristol Bay, and has for multiple generations. And so salmon, I think, is probably the first thing. I wanted to ask about sort of what other ingredients or food items do you think of as being quintessentially Alaskan that we might not think of that way in the lower 48?
Yeah, so if you think of, okay, what is our cuisine in Alaska, and what influences our foods, and what might someone with fresh eyes find here uniquely. Certainly, we have a lot of Russian influence in our day-to-day world. We Russians were the first to come in with gardens, and so they were growing cabbages and cold weather crops, beets, cabbages, beets, all this sort of cold weather stuff, and all of those food sources are still popular in Alaska cuisine. And there's quite a few Russians that live here, even. We're the closest point to Russia. If for the United States, we're the closest to China, we're the closest to Japan. We all share that Pacific Ocean, so I think there's a lot of affinity with those countries, and we're also trade partners with some of those countries. And so there's a definitely a Russian thread through. There's certainly a Nordic vibe. The kind of like the circumpolar kind of communities, not necessarily Pacific Northwest. Like Seattle's very different. Somehow, like we don't have huckleberries, we don't have hazelnuts, but we do of course share seafood and an interest in salmon. We definitely have a native Alaska indigenous people, native consideration. You know, we smoke salmon all the time. We're
Sure.
smoking things on over alderwood often. And I think really the pioneers, the gold miner, you know, the gold rush people, they came up here with sourdough, you know, around their necks on little leather bags from
Right.
San Francisco. They didn't know then you could freeze sourdough and
Right.
reconstitute it.
Sure.
Kind of silly, huh? But you know, so there, you know, there's this, you know, sourdough and sort of hearty, very hearty, homesteady food that, you know, we can make it through the winter kind of attitude, I guess, in, you know, in terms of our cuisine. You know, I think that there's a lot of resilience and independence in Alaska, within Alaskans, and so, you know, being able to cook well for oneself. A lot of people live in communities without, you know, very many restaurants, or you know, or live remotely on a boat, on a
Right.
fishing boat, like your friend on a fishing boat, et cetera. You know, that have to really take good care of themselves. And so I think that there's a lot of really, really great cooks in Alaska that prepare food in a creative way at home. That's just sort of kind of a hidden secret, you know,
Yeah.
undertone.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I was just looking at the recipe for braised reindeer stew with dark beer. And you know, while it's 85 degrees out and humid here, it's not exactly the dish that I would be thinking about making today. But looking at it, you mentioned like a Nordic influence, and to me that sounds very much like, you know, like Nordic. Like I would want to have that with like some rye bread.
Something very hearty
I don't
and
know. I don't know where I can get reindeer steak here. I'll have to
yeah, you
maybe
can substitute beef, but you know, when my girls were little, they ate moose meat most of the time, and well, the first time my daughter ate a piece of beef, she thought it was rancid and she spit it out, you know, because it's quite a bit
Sure.
fattier.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Yeah. I mean, wild animals are often much less, much more lean, than we get in our agricultural animals for sure. What kind of things are you foraging now? So, I mean, I guess one of the things that I'm interested to understand is what the seasonality is like. You know, like I said, like it's, you know, we are like fully in summer here in the Northeast. I imagine that Alaska, you guys are not quite there yet, although I guess you're headed towards the longest day. I mean, the longest day of the year would have just happened, right? Where, I mean,
The solstice was on the
yeah.
21st of June, and that's the longest day where we live at our latitude. The sun's still not really going down yet until, you know, sometime in August at Tutka Bay Lodge. So Mandy and I are super lucky that, you know, we live both on the ocean and in the mountains, so
Yeah.
we have this ability to have two locations. But at Tutka Bay, we forage a lot of seaweed at low tide. I really love the seaweed sea lettuce. It's kind of almost looks like cellophane, and
Yeah.
we dry the sea lettuce and crumble it up into everything. We have a lot of other sea related little sea greens and, you know, other seaweeds. And then on our property, we're right, the property is interesting there at Tutka Bay because we're in a cove, an ocean cove, but then we have this old growth forest right abutting right up to the shoreline. So literally steps away, then we can be in a forest with, you know, tons of mushrooms. And we do have a lot of morels in the springtime and fall in Alaska. At Tutka Bay in particular, we have quite a few different mushrooms. We have a lot of wild berries. Salmon berry is an interesting, beautiful, gorgeous berry that we have in abundance. We have blueberries in abundance. Those won't be ready quite until about the first week of August. We're right now we're picking the little delicate sort of light green spruce tips, and
Yeah.
we use the spruce tips in food and also sometimes in drinks. And you know, we dry them for the winter.
Yeah, spruce chips are really great. That's something that I forage here, except we're well past that time now. So when I first got your book a couple of weeks ago, I actually made a batch of the spruce sugar that's in here. And I've been using it on a bunch of stuff, 'cause it's really, it's delicious, and it really couldn't be any easier. I definitely encourage people to go out next spring, at least in the Northeast, but I guess if you're somewhere like Alaska, you can go forage spruce now.
At Winter Lake Lodge, the ice didn't go out of our lake until the first week of June. And but things happen. I mean, you have to blink and something changes with our intense sunlight right now. So every day is intense. Every day is a little different, and new things are popping up and unfolding. It's July is really, I think, July and early August are when, all the flowers are out, everything's green, everything's lush. And then towards the end of August, it starts to get dark again at night, which is really gorgeous when if you've lived with daylight off. But we have some bioluminescence in our water, so in the ocean, and so we
Oh,
can, at
beautiful.
nighttime when it's really dark, we can see the little creatures swirling around. And so we appreciate winter, we appreciate all the seasons, but they're very fast. I mean, spring's a sliver of a moment,
Right.
fall's pretty quick, and then basically it's a whole lot of winter, and
Yeah.
then three to if you stretch it, 4 months of summer.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about the light. So, that's something that I hadn't really connected to the ability to like grow your own food or what was happening with the trees and stuff. This, the fact that it essentially the sun doesn't set. Or you have very little nighttime for quite a long time, and some plants, are reliant on the change or the amount of sunlight they get to do things like produce flowers or produce fruit. And so, I would love to understand, and also how it affects you as a person, because I imagine that you guys have developed over, living there an entire or most of a lifetime. You've developed ways to kind of deal with the fact that, like, if you wake up at 2:30 in the morning because you have to use the bathroom or whatever, that it's just as bright out as it is at noon, right? Whereas
Yeah,
visitors, I'm sure, find that to be really, really like off-putting and kind of like difficult.
for me personally, I mean, many Alaskans have lights and like sad lights in the winter
Sure,
and all sorts of other things. But for me, it's never ever bothered me. I'm not fussed or bothered by light in the evening or different, photo periods. But we do have like blackout curtains in our guest cabins, and we have eye patches for them, everything so that they can have find darkness in the evening. And I do know that probably I'm just so conditioned from living here for so long that I don't notice it anymore. But we definitely have different energy. I mean, we could be out playing volleyball at midnight, like, oops, it's midnight. We better go to bed. And then in the winter, we're sort of padding around in our jammies at 10 o'clock in the morning, like, oh, should we get up yet? So it's definitely two different paces. And in the summer, everything happens. The fish are here. The guests are here. The things need to be harvested and picked. And it's a flurry of a busy time, as it has always been. I mean, it was that way for native people 1,000 years ago, as it is for us now. We're just doing different activities, I guess.
Absolutely. What do you think the most important thing is that you want people to know about either Alaska or the way of life there? Like, what's the big takeaway from people who visit your lodges or who buy your cookbook?
Well, I think that what I want to do is show people that there are still places in the world that are wild and free, and I want them to consider the potential when they go home of looking at their own communities or their own countries or their own countrysides, and considering the preservation of wild places. And I deeply appreciate urban communities and landscapes, and I understand that we need to move forward as, you know, in terms of economics. But, you know, if we understand the fragility and the complexity of the natural world and just try to preserve these places. You know, Bristol Bay has been under attack, and if the salmon, Bristol Bay is the, you know, world's largest salmon returning spawning grounds.
Yep.
If Bristol Bay is gone, there is no other Bristol Bay.
Right.
You know, it's not endless, it's finite. And, you know, just to have those moments, like if I can take a guest from Beijing or Mumbai and have them stand there and feel that powerful feeling of looking out across to nothing, and they go home and they contemplate that, I think then, you know, that's been a success. As far as, you know, us as a family and a business, you know, our mission is really to bring people together when they travel. So, you know, as you probably do as well, I love that moment of when everybody's at the table and they're talking and they're laughing and they're, you know, they're having some sort of memory together. And that, you know, I think our food, you know, hopefully orchestrates those moments where they're coming together. I worked in the intensive care unit when I was very young. That's basically at the sort of end of life where people are in crisis and dying. And I really wanted to move into that bright, shiny, you know, middle of life where we're all having fun, we're traveling, we're having big lives, we're laughing. And I was able to do that, which is really, you know, it's really been a wonderful honor to do that work. And I feel like our food, you know, our cuisine, I hope it's not too regional for everybody. And I hope the stories of our lives can just show you that really you can take a, for younger people, they can take a divergent path and, you know, find a way to make a living. You know, Carl and I figured out how to make a living, how to raise two kids. They both went to college, and we did that, you know, hundreds of miles from anywhere. You know,
right.
how do you survive out in the middle of nowhere? Well, you make a plan and you do it.
Hey everybody, Harry Rosenblum here from Feast Your Ears. Every week, I talk to people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. And I wanted to make sure that you know that HRN runs on listener support. It's up to you to keep us on the air. Every week, I try to do my best to bring you interesting stories from across the globe and across the street. But if you enjoy this podcast, the best way to show your support is to become a member. You can set up a monthly recurring donation of any amount, $1, $5, $10, $1,000, whatever you want, and choose the show in the designation drop-down menu. So if you want to support everything, you can do that. If you want to support me and Feast Your Ears, you can do that too. Become a monthly sustaining member at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. I wanted to sort of, I guess, move on and talk about the cooking school on a boat. So I, you know, in researching this, it kind of, I started to look at that and sort of my, you know, my wife runs a cooking school, not on a boat, in a kitchen space. So, you know, I would love to, you know, tell me the story of how you ended up with a, you know, I mean, ending up with a boat, I imagine in Alaska is not that hard, but how you ended up with a boat that then became a cooking school.
Yeah. If you go to our website, to Within the Wild, I don't know if we have any pictures, many pictures of it, but it's really an incredible space. So where Tutka Bay Lodge is, we had neighbors that we actually didn't know we had. The previous owners never mentioned them, and you can't really see them through all the trees and the, you know, woods. And in Tutka Bay, I purchased it almost as kind of like an impulse purchase, and I sort of told my husband afterwards. So yeah, I hope your wife's listening. You can't do that, right? And when my husband went down to Tucker Bay and was looking around, he's like, "Oh, you have to come over and look at this what's over the hill." And the neighbor had pulled up an old 85 or 87 foot ship really onto the shore, and it was a derelict ship. It's a wooden ship that was a crabbing boat, out in the Bering Sea, and it had a long history of doing some very. It was a troop transport carrier in World War II and et cetera. Well, he had built this two-story structure on top of the boat, and when I first looked at it, I thought, "Oh, that is so ugly. It's, it's the ugliest thing I've ever seen." But then, I kind of went on a campaign, for in part our privacy and just the seclusion of our guests, and just a sort of preservation of land around us. I went on a campaign to purchase it from him, and it took me almost a year to come into an agreement. Well, when he finally agreed to sell it to us, Mandy and I, my daughter Mandy and I were guest chefs on a cruise ship on Holland America, and we were in the Straits of Gibraltar, and there was a huge storm. We couldn't actually land in Gibraltar because the storm was so bad and the way the port is there. And so the whatever somebody asked, "Can you do another like on the spot, on the fly cooking class for us?" And we said, "Yeah, sure, of course we can." And the ship was rocking so much, to the left and right, like all our bowls and everything would just like slide down the countertop to one end, and then they'd slide down to the other end. And, we got back to our stateroom, and we had the little message that he had accepted our offer. And we thought, "Oh, you know what? If we can cook, if we can teach here, right? If we can
Right.
teach on this, ship today in a storm, we can do it anywhere. Let's turn it into a cooking school." So it was almost a no-brainer for us because we love to share what we know. Obviously, we write books and
Yeah.
we like to teach, and we offer, cooking classes for our guests in the kitchens of the lodge. But we decided we wanted to do also something for our community. And one way, because our lodge is so private, one way to bring community people over there was to have the cooking school. So we offer 12 people that can come. We open it 3 days a week, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. This year, unfortunately, and last year, we aren't operating because of
Right.
COVID restrictions, but we're really hoping and excited to start it up again next year. And it's totally kind of non-stainless steel kitchen. We do everything a mono, and it works fine. It's great. We have these like a big wood root balls, tree root balls that are chandeliers hanging over this long table that seats 24 people. And it's just been really a great way to connect with people that I wouldn't meet normally, and in our community mostly, or in a lot of our guests are Alaskans, because then it's a way they can afford to come over and
Sure.
spend some time with us. And our lodges are a little expensive, and not totally targeted for Alaskans in that sense, in that regard.
Right.
But I just love it. I love communicating through food, and I love communicating through the story of food, and sharing what I know.
It's awesome. I really like I want to come, and I
I
want to
want
cook.
you to
I want to cook on your cooking school boat. It's
come.
so cool.
Yeah.
So you brought it up a little bit there. I wanted to ask, I mean, I've spent a lot of time in resort sort of areas, and there's often kind of an undercurrent I find of like a little bit of a conflict between locals and visitors, even though the locals often in the economy rely very heavily on the dollars that the visitors bring in. And I wanted to know, I mean, is that something that you find to be present, or is I mean, or is Alaska so sort of vast in these places, not exactly like in any kind of metropolitan area, that it doesn't happen? I'm just curious.
Well, definitely that's true for Winter Lake Lodge. We have no neighbors there, so
Right.
being community minded is a broader concept at Winter Lake, since we don't have a community to lean into. At Tutka Bay, we're half an hour by boat away from the town of Homer, where Mandy has the cafe. There, I think it's a gorgeous, really fun town. There's a lot of artists. There's a lot of musicians living there. It's kind of a I don't know, like a retro hippie vibe there. But the community is sort of interesting in that there's a lot of commercial fishermen, salt of the earth people going out and making a living every day on the ocean. And then there seems to be a little bit of conflict or misunderstanding between commercial fishermen and tourism user groups. I mean, sport fishermen versus commercial fishermen et cetera. And that's probably true almost anywhere. And finding common ground is super important for me. And I try to be very active in local issues in which we can look for ways to, bridge understanding and to sort of, prevent misunderstanding. But we, we have a lot of initiatives at our lodges where We're really in the sustainability space. We're community and culture is very important to us. At Tutka Bay, we have several archaeologic sites on our property. And one site that we have is an old 1,000-year-old hearth where the indigenous people would prepare food at this hearth. And it really captivates me because I want to know and see and understand who was there 1,000 years ago.
Right.
but we really try to reach out and, try to be a part of our community. And the cafe is a cafe is a good outlet for that too. It's very, very popular amongst locals in Homer. And, we try to do a lot of community contribution as, almost all chefs do on some level.
I mean, you mentioned when I asked before the show, where you thought of a great place to sit, and you mentioned sitting at the cafe in the early morning watching fishermen leave the harbor. And I think that is important. I mean, it is also important, I would hope, for the guests who are coming to see you. I mean, if they're going to Winter Lake and they want to be in that wilderness, they still have to pass through other parts of Alaska and kind of understand that there is a wider community there, if not a direct community. And especially with something like fishing, I mean, I recently joined the board of directors for a small nonprofit here in the Northeast whose mission is to promote sustainability in commercial seafood and promote, people actually purchasing local seafood rather than seafood from further away that is often, not always, but often much less sustainable. And the idea that, somebody who goes into a fish market here, if they're buying farmed salmon or farmed shrimp, which are, of course, sadly going to remain the most popular seafoods in America, they're not buying the local cod or the local fluke or the local oysters that were probably harvested or caught by their neighbors.
Yeah, for example, just yesterday I bought 25 whole sockeye salmon from a small family boat in Bristol Bay. And so, they have to bring the fish to Anchorage and I have to meet them somewhere, down a dark alley and, get the fish. And, sometimes there's a little bit more labor to that, but the reward is so great. I mean, I feel so good about working with that family than going to a big fish wholesaler where I don't know where the fish is coming from, really.
And that family may be selling some of their catch to that wholesaler, but for less money.
That's right.
Right.
Absolutely.
So then you're helping to get the dollars, directly to the, to the fishermen and family and stuff.
Yeah.
That's great.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah. We have an employee on our, we're a tiny company, but we have one employee that his title is expediter. But what we mean by that title is that his job is to sort of, find, source out these these resources that are
Right.
often small and often changing. You know, sometimes people aren't there the next year that were there the year before. And we commit a certain amount of money to just supporting the local farmers markets, and you know, whatever he finds, he sends out to the lodges, and then the team can weave it into their menus. And so, you know, we really enjoy making that effort. He gets oddball stuff too. You know, he has access to some harder to get Alaskan oddball products, you know, like certain kinds of game and stuff
Sure.
that he enjoys. I don't know how I feel about that, but you know, he ferments a lot of things, and he sends all that stuff out to the lodges then, and so they have kind of a person in the field doing that for them.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds very much to me, having spent so much time in New England, that there's this sort of like New England hardiness that people kind of think of and refer to, but it doesn't fully exist anymore. As far as, you know, people who are, you know, raising their own chickens and foraging and drying mushrooms for the winter and that kind of thing. I feel like it's sort of a historical footnote here. It's not the way that most people live today, but it sounds like that kind of life is still really active and happening in Alaska.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
I wanted to ask about, you guys are starting a nonprofit to help preserve wild land. So I commend you. I think that's amazing. I mean, you, as far as I understand, you just secured 24 acres near the Tutka Bay Lodge to add into this. But I guess that the other side of the coin, or the other side of the question that I have is, what's threatening the land in Alaska if there seems to be so much of it?
Well, you know, there's a lot of land in Alaska. I think there's, you know, I don't really remember now. I think it's something like 400 million acres. The acreage here. But a lot of it is Arctic, tundra,
right.
Inaccessible land. You know, a lot of it, humans have clustered around the prime spots along
sure.
the ocean and you know, good ports and good fishing access, etc. So the real threat to natural wild places in Alaska is development always. So near Winter Lake, there's a very large gold mine going in, hoping to go in. Extraction of natural resources is probably one of Alaska's primary industries, and it's definitely one of Alaska's primary potential industries. So, you know, certainly oil development and natural gas, minerals like gold and copper and other sorts of extractive minerals. And so, you know, oftentimes to put in a gold mine, you have to build a road to get supplies in. And then you have to have, you know, there's a lot of infrastructure development ideas. I don't disrespect people who are miners or who make a living with an extractive kind of industry. It's just not my focus. I want to make sure the state parks are intact and people aren't trying to whittle little pieces away for forestry harvest or, you know, et cetera. So, and there's other entities in Alaska that work on land preservation. But our focus is a little bit more on micro properties that can really influence a community or affect a particular place. So this acreage that we obtained from the state of Alaska was up for bid. So, you know, anybody could go in there and obtain it and then do anything with it, maybe
right.
build condos or,
sure.
you know, build 7-Elevens. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, anything could
Right.
happen.
Right.
Cut every single tree down on the land and sell it, you know, cheaply to somebody, right,
Right.
to make something. So the reason why we went through that difficulty and expense was because the area of Tutka Bay does have a, you know, some little behind us, there's a few cabins where people come for the weekend and a few people that are living year round. I mean, in that place, it would be devastating for all of us, every single person there, if that gorgeous intact old growth forest was damaged.
Right.
And so the our idea is there's other, you know, micro plots of land that come available. I'm going on Saturday. I'm flying out to a remote wild outer coast of the Alaska Gulf of Alaska to look at 15 acres that's for sale by a private landowner who has property within the a state park. And then so my ultimate goal is hopefully maybe I could donate that land back to the state park and preserve it.
Got it. Wow. I
And it's
mean,
just
it, yeah,
you know, I don't want to say it's a hobby, but it's important to me to, you know, leave things better than when I came.
Yep.
And so I want to, you know, I want to try for me, like securing, you know, really cool places where your grandchildren can come up and see that wild million acres or see that wild Alaska. You know, that's important to me.
Yeah. Absolutely. And again, like I commend you on that. Now, when you say you're flying to those places, is that's not on a commercial plane, I assume?
No, it's a chart. You know, we have air taxis
Yeah,
here in
right.
Alaska. Yeah, and so and you know, many people fly in Alaska and have their own planes. And I would not personally want to be a pilot. I just, you know, charter planes.
Right.
So yeah, so you know, an air taxi will fly me out about an I don't know, about an hour and a half from where I am right now. And then, yeah, he'll land on a lake, and then, you know, I'll trudge around it with my little
Right.
backpack, take a bunch of pictures.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
Yeah.
again, like I want people to understand that, like, the way that we think of travel, even in the lower 48, that like, I can get on a road and drive from where I am. My family owns a cottage in Maine, and I can get there in about 5.5 hours. But to go that same distance in Alaska, in fact, often you have to fly because there aren't interstates that would connect places that would be 5 hours apart by car. So, I mean, I think it's an interesting like scale to think about that actually you'd be going further, but it might actually take you less time.
Yeah, I've been dreaming of getting one of those, you know, those sprinter vans and then decking it out with a bed and a kitchen
Yeah.
inside it, you
Yeah.
know, hitting the road. And you know, then the reality is like, okay, wait, where, you know, there's one road north to Fairbanks, there's one road south to home, or where would we go? And then also like sitting, you know, in a vehicle. I'm not really a drive, you know, I don't like to drive that much. So, you know,
Sure.
like sitting in a vehicle with my husband, what would we talk, you know? It's like, eh, okay, all right, forget it. All right, one dream, check off, throw it
Yeah, I mean,
in
I
the
guess if you felt like you wanted like to access smaller wilderness with cities in between, you could come down to the lower 48 and like rent one for a month and drive around
Yeah.
if that's what you
Yeah,
decided you were
actually,
really after.
yeah, that's what we're sort of thinking about doing over the, you know, maybe the holidays is going to like, you know, Zion National Park or
Sure.
something and renting one of those little vans. And I
Yeah.
don't know, you know, I don't know.
Well, Kristen, it's been a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for taking the time out of the extremely long day, because the sun will be up all day and all night for you. Is there anything else that we didn't get to cover in our conversation?
Well, no, I just hope, you know, everyone listening knows that Alaska is, you know, their one of their states, and you know, our national parks here and their state parks here, and there's interesting things to see and do and experience and eat and visiting us may potentially change your life in some small way. And so I hope everybody will have the opportunity to come and see one of our places, your place, your park, your shoreline and your ocean sometime in your life.
Thanks for listening to Feast Your Ears today. You can follow the Dixon family and their businesses at Within the Wild on Instagram and Twitter, and check out withinthewild.com for more information about how to book a stay and an adventure with these fine folks. You can find Feast Your Ears, as well as lots of other great shows, at heritageradionetwork.org, on iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please reach out if you have any questions. You can reach me via email, harry@thebrooklynkitchen.com, and you can follow me on Instagram, @thefoodballer. Feast Your Ears is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter, @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.